The topics and opinions expressed in the following show are solely those of the hosts and their guests and not those of W4CY Radio, its employees, or affiliates. We make no recommendations or endorsements for radio show programs, services, or products mentioned on air or on our web. No liability, explicit or implied, shall be extended to W4CY Radio or its employees or affiliates. Any questions or comments should be directed to those show hosts. Thank you for choosing W4CY Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Connected Table Live. We're your hosts, Melanie Young and David Ransom, your insatiably curious culinary couple. Each week we bring you the amazing people who were front and center and behind the scenes in wine, food, spirits, and hospitality around the world. We love doing this from wherever we are in the world. Right now we're still in the United States, and it's the end of the year. It's December 29th, 2021. And I don't know about you, David. Hi, David. David and I are in different locations. If we do speak over each other, it's because we can't see each other. Hi, David.
We're a couple of states away from each other today, yes. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. I'm kind of excited to bid adieu to 2021.
Yes.
Bienvenue to 2022.
I don't think you'll find much argument with that from anybody.
Although we've had a pretty good year, David. I mean, let's just face it. We've been living on the road, life in Rome, R-A-M. Life is a swirl. We've traveled a lot. Most people haven't. So we have to be grateful. We're healthy. Some people haven't. We're grateful. We've pretty much, you know, been writing regularly, doing our shows. I think we should be celebrating and saying thank you for what we do have, because we've got a lot, and I'm glad.
Well, you know, we did. There were some ups and downs, but a lot of it was ups for us personally. And we've had a great year, and we've actually gotten to the four corners of the country, north, south, east, and west, and the middle in between. So it's kind of been a great year for both of us.
Yeah, I'm feeling upbeat. So speaking of the middle, we're taking you right in the middle of the United States today to Chicago, which I have to tell you, David and I picked up this yay project. Thank you, Wines of Provence. Grateful. That took us from California to Chicago to New York and back to where we are now, which is in different places. But here's the thing. I think every time I personally have been in Chicago, I don't know about you, David, it's always been January. Right?
Most like of the time, it seems to be. Although like my first trip there was in August January. And it was hot.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I don't know. I just always remember Chicago in January. So the great thing is that we were there in September, which has to be one of the most beautiful months of the year to be in Chicago. And we did all these fun touristy things that we never got to do because we were always working, like that great skyscraper boat tour, right?
Yeah, they're very famous for their architecture in Chicago and the skyscrapers that they created and the wonderful architects that designed them and things like that. So they're quite proud of it, and they have architecture tours on the river every day and whatnot. So we did one of those. It was actually fascinating, and we both learned a lot.
Chicago is the birthplace of the modern skyscraper. That was a fun fact I actually did not know. And now when I go, and I actually found the hotel we were staying at, the Swiss Hotel, was on the tour. Like, our hotel was on the tour. It was so cool. Now when I look at skyscrapers in other cities, I think back about what I learned on that Chicago tour. So everybody listening, if you are going to Chicago, even if you're working like we always were, take the tour. Get out and walk. We also walked along the streets and discovered a lot of interesting neighborhoods, which I think, thank you, it was warmer weather, so we did that. So another thing people may know more about Chicago is it's known for its blues and its music.
And its food.
And then, of course, its food, which is where we come to now. Chicago is probably one of the great dining destinations in the United States, often, way too often, overshadowed by its, you know, West Coast sisters and New York City. But it is the heartland, and it's dining with a heart. The people there have a heart. And that is going to lead me to our guest today, who is a chef restaurateur with a generous heart, who welcomed us with open arms when we showed up at her restaurant no reservations. We wanted to sit at the bar on a Saturday. Let's just talk about that. How silly was that? But we did it, and we got our seat, and she came out and welcomed us, and we had more than a light bite. It was pretty awesome. So our guest today is Carrie Nahabedian, and we're talking about her latest restaurant and a really fabulous one, Brindle. I hope I got the names correct. And we're going to talk about her amazing story. So Carrie, welcome.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here. Hope everyone had a great holiday. And yes, let's kick 2021 to the curb, and we're ready for the new year, aren't we all?
Even though I was born in an odd year, I tend to like even years better. So let's move on to 2022.
Well, I think you were ready to quick 2020. You had a rough 2020, as I remember, between 2020 and 2021. Carrie, you've been through the ropes.
I think everyone has had their own trials and tribulations, and I think we've gotten stronger because of it. But, you know, we're just all hoping for a happier, brighter new year. So that's, you know, that's all we can ask for. All we got to do is do our part. That's it.
Exactly.
Couldn't agree with you more. But, you know, we're already digressing from our promise to each other before the,
I know.
Before the show, saying we weren't going to talk about that. So let's talk about you and your career and the Carrie Show. So let's do that.
So first of all, you're a native Chicagoan. Did you grow up in the burbs?
I did. I was born in the city, of course, but my family, we lived in the northern suburbs and just, you know, 20 minutes from downtown. Some of our family still lives in the same town that we are. And my mother's from outside Boston in Worcester, and my father was a Chicagoan, and they had a really great love story, how they met right after World War II. And so happy to live in Chicago. And it is the number one restaurant city in America for two or three years running right now by a new number of publications. So I'm sure you dined really well when you were here.
Well, certainly
did.
We needed more time, right? We certainly needed more time. You know, we always dine well there, though. I love Chicago's restaurant scene. It's vibrant. It's always changing. And it's really got a lot to give the country. And I've always enjoyed every meal I've had there.
And I have to say, it's a really strong chef community. And it's even gotten stronger during what we've all gone through. But it's a really strong, independent, diverse, you know, when people ask me, I'm coming to Chicago, where should I eat? The next question I ask is, how long are you here for and what is your main focus? So, you know, because whether you're having deep dish pizza or hot dogs or you're having a 3-star Michelin meal, there's everything for everyone. And that's what makes the city so appealing to everyone.
Absolutely. Speaking of Michelin, you've earned one.
Right. At Naha, we had it.
Yes. Yes, you did. You had Naha for 18 years, but let's go back. We're curious. So, you know, you did mention a love story in there, which you will have to share at some point about how your parents met, because you can't just lead us on like that with it's a great love story. Okay.
I won't. I'll tell you. I mean, my parents were married almost, 70 years when my father passed away a few years ago. So it is a great love story. She opened the door, she saw him and said to her mother, "This is the man I'm going to marry." So that's how it happened, basically.
It was a good thing it wasn't like the UPS guy. I mean, what was... A lot of people knock on my door, but I don't say he's going to marry
me. I've never. It's like when people say, I met my husband on an airplane or I met my wife on an airplane. It's like, really? I don't think I've ever, you know, I might engage in a conversation with someone, but I've certainly never, you know, taken the next step further and even like maybe even shared my last name or given a business card. So, you know, I'm always amazed when people find love at first sight. So there it goes. It does happen.
You know, David, I had a huge crush on David when I met him first sight, by the way. He was with somebody else.
But I was dating somebody else. And, you know, my parents had that same experience, Carrie. My mother actually went out on a date with my uncle before she met my dad. And she came to the house, and my father had just come back for Christmas. And she walked in the door and saw my dad, and that was it.
Yeah. Oh, that's so sweet.
I know. I think it's very in our industry, you know, to, you know, I'm amazed when people in our industry are married and have sustainable relationships mm-hmm. and kids and everything, because it is such a demanding world that, you know, it's so rewarding. It's a ton of fun. And to quote my sister, who was a banker, I took her from being a banker and I said, Michael and I need you. When we were opening Naha in 2000, I went to my sister and said, we can't do this without you. And I went to my oldest sister, Chris. That was Kathy. I went to my oldest sister, Chris, and said the same thing. We can't do this without you. And my father looked at me and said, so you're taking my daughters who live in the town, who work and live in the town, and now you're going to make them take a train and a bus to the restaurant every single day? And I said, yes. He said, okay, well, then you better make it. You better make it, kind of like that. And so I will say that you need to surround yourself with great people, and I'm very lucky. But my sister says to me all the time, the day just flies by when you work in a restaurant, mm-hmm. you know, and it is true.
So how many family members work with you? I mean, you know your cousin Michael works with you as a partner, and he's the wine director. We know Michael.
How many family members
work with you?
Michael does basically everything. You know, we kind of have a dividing line, and anything that falls over, we kind of just figure it all out. And he handles everything except cooking, and I handle everything except, you know, serving the guests and being in the front of the house. And I mean, I'll go out and greet people, but it's still a joke that after all these years, I still don't know, you know, most table numbers, because it's not my job to know the table numbers. But Michael's brother, Tom, my cousin Tom Nahabedian, is the architect and designer of Naha and Brondi, which he won the James Beard Award for best design.
Okay, Brondi. I completely mispronounced it in the beginning.
We never correct anyone. I mean, you have to remember we're American, so, you know, people call it Brindle, Brondi. You know, I've heard it from, you know, Corinne from one of our companies that we do our china with. When she said it in French, we recorded it, so we always knew how to say it.
And that's fabulous.
Michael came up with the name. So, and then Tom designed Castali, which is our other restaurant at the Gwen Hotel. So he doesn't really necessarily work, you know, at the restaurant, but as he says all the time, just because I designed and was the architect and designed your restaurant doesn't mean that you can call me every day when you don't know how to change a light bulb, kind of thing. but my older sister, Kathy, I'm the youngest. Kathy handles the financials. My sister, Chris, is retired, and she still helps us with anything that we can't find the time to do, like, or don't have the patience for, and she does all the things that can fall through the cracks and become a big problem. So she takes care of that. But over the years, we've had just about every one of our cousins be coat check, or, you know, Michael's nephew George, my cousin, has started out to learn how to be a back waiter and a barista until becoming a baseball player and going to college. Those plans overtook being in the restaurant industry. So basically it's Michael and I, my sister Kathy. That's the everyday in and out of our restaurant.
That's amazing. I did not realize that. But let's just talk about Tom Nahabedian, because
okay.
Brondi, and just for listeners, it's spelled Brindille. That's why I mispronounced it. It means twig in French.
Like a branch with a new growth. And I've heard from some French people that they used to call, like, their kids when they were, like, a young teenager, before they were actually 13 or 14, when they were just becoming a teenager, they would, when you're lanky and kind of awkward and you didn't know which way direction you're going, they'd say, oh, I'd call my daughter a Brondi, because she was kind of just going in all directions. So
petite Brondi. But Tom, with Brondi, won a James Beard Foundation Award for Best Design. Okay, in a city known for architecture, Chicago, for an award program that actually takes place now in Chicago, for recognition as an outstanding restaurant design, that's pretty awesome.
It's incredible, and I love that you took the architectural boat tour, because having a cousin who's an architect, they're you know, I know more about most buildings than I ever thought I would ever know. So it is, you know, he makes you look at design and architecture different than the average person. So I think we all have a, you know, Tom is extraordinary in the fact that he does everything so effortlessly, you know, everything is so seamless, and he has a very clean approach, and he knew immediately what Brundy was going to become, and he commissioned the artwork with the artist Laura Fosberg, and that's how you see the Brundy everywhere, you know, all the different conifers in the forest. But it was Michael who came up with the name, and he talked with Tom and said, this is what I envision, and Tom came up with the style, the look, the, you know, what, you know, just a room for all the ages. And yesterday I talked to a table and they said to me, this is our room. We just love it here because we feel so special, we're relaxed, we're comfortable, and I think that's what we're looking for. Like a restaurant like Brundy in London or Paris, you find them, you know, in every upmarket neighborhood, the look and the feel. But in Chicago, it's more of a sneak. And even in New York, it'd be more of a sneak. To have a 50-seat restaurant in downtown Chicago and be able to come and eat a full meal, do whatever you want at the bar like you did, we're very happy that you were able to experience it because it is quite a special place. Thank you for recognizing that.
Oh, yeah, we loved it. Absolutely.
David, I posted on Facebook we're going to Chicago, and Carrie, you were the first person who said, come to the restaurant. And I said, David, we got to go see Carrie. We've always wanted to go to the show, and I haven't seen her since she closed Naha, which, by the way, was a fabulous restaurant.
I know.
One of my favorites in Chicago.
Thank you. I mean, it was a great run, 18 years, and, yeah. You know, we kind of brought the best of Naha over to Castalli, and we do have envisions of reopening it, and then this little thing called the pandemic came about, and we, you know, and life gets in the way, and sometimes you just take a different path, and Brundy is 8 years, almost 9 years. Next year in the spring, it'll be 9 years that we're there.
Oh, that's great. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
You know, Carrie, I want to kind of take it back a little bit and talk about what got you started in food. You're obviously a very successful restaurateur. You're a wonderful chef and whatnot. But what got you the bug to say, I want to be a chef? How'd that happen?
You know, I'll try to condense it because I've said it, you know, it's difficult to put a whole career. I mean, I've been cooking for over 40 years. But I would say that, first off, I come from a family of really tremendous home cooks. My mother, though she's 92 and doesn't cook anymore, she instilled in me what I have. And though she didn't cook like I do, she instilled in me the quality and just setting the table and just, you know, making a great memory. And my grandmother and all my aunts, every single one has their own specialty. So we're Armenians, and Michael's mom is Greek, and we have an uncle who's Italian. So we have had always at every great family event, we had great food. So I think it happened when my mother always tells me, and my father would say, that they knew at a very young age that I was going to be someone different because of just the way that I handled things and my detail and how I did things differently from other people in terms of, you know, my mother would say, like, when I dusted the living room, I picked up every item, looked at it, dusted it, put it back. Whereas, you know, my sisters just dusted around it, moved on. But, you know, that's the obsessiveness that I have that I probably every year I say I'm going to get rid of it in my resolution, but I can't seem to break. But I was 17. I was in high school. I had a great work program, home economics teacher, and you had to work where food was being produced, so that could mean anything. And my father at the time, this is where the whole love story comes in, my father at the time was doing carpet for Marshall Fields in Chicago, and they were opening the Ritz-Carlton, which was the first luxury hotel to open in Chicago. And my father would come home every day and talk about, oh, all these chefs are from France and you should see them. And I speak French to them because, you know, my dad was in war, was in the war in the European campaign. And though he almost died in France, he loves France, and he spoke to them. And I said to him, you have to get me a job there. I have to work there. I knew at that age, I took the Time Life cooking from provincial France off my mother's cookbook shelf. And while she was recovering from a health issue, at 17, I cooked the entire book for the whole, for my mother and my father. My sisters were at college, and I cooked the entire book. And by the time I was, you know, a junior, senior in high school, I knew that I wasn't going to go to college and I was going to be a chef.
Wait, what was the name of the book?
Cooking from Provincial France.
Wow.
That's the Time Life book that you can still get, you know, on eBay every once in a while. And it's got the big cheese souffle on the cover. Mm-hmm. And it's an amazing book. The Time Life books are great because they tell a story. And so, long story short, my dad went to the chef at the Ritz-Carlton, very imposing man, and said in French that he was in Normandy and he was part of the liberation of Paris, and he, you know, was wounded in the countryside, and he was in, you know, and I have a daughter who's crazy about cooking, and mm-hmm. you know, the chefs, you know, hearing an American who helped save their country and save the world, basically, you know, the Americans and the Allies, they said, okay, give her an application and we'll bring her in. And I was very fortunate to go to a school that was very progressive, one of the biggest high schools on the North Shore, Maine East in Park Ridge. And I got a job. That's how I got the job. And I always say I don't know where my career would have been had my dad not been in World War II, had he not been in France, had he not learned French, had he not been working at the Ritz. And that's how it started. I couldn't work in the kitchen because I was too young, so I started in room service, and the chef kept watching me because I would go hang out. Every time I had an order, I'd be standing by the side of the line watching it. You have to remember, all these chefs came from France. I mean, this was the late 70s, and everyone was coming. And the place was, I mean, the Ritz was the place. There hadn't been a place like this to open. You know, Madame Ritz opened it. Anything of this luxury hadn't been open in Chicago in a long time. And finally, the chef got tired of me begging him and saying, he watched me, he saw my detail, and he probably figured, okay, I'll put her in garmage and she can make canapes or something. And so they let me come into the kitchen, and very quickly they recognized that I had a natural talent, and I met my first mentor, which was Fernand Gutierrez, the late Fernand Gutierrez, who mentored a number of women chefs and chefs for Four Seasons, which ultimately the Ritz became a Four Seasons. And that's how it all started. And I was 17, I was in high school, and I was working 48 hours a week. Wow. And I would take a bus, two trains, and I'd walk to the Ritz, and my father would pick me up every night at like 11 o'clock. And then finally he got sick of it and he gave me a car. And then when I graduated high school, my sisters and I moved downtown into an apartment my parents owned, and I walked to work every day. And that's how it all started. And from the Ritz opening the door, I met the men that shaped my future, Jean Bonchet. I met the whole French mafia at the time, which we called all the French chefs in Chicago at the time. It was a friendly, amicable term because they were, you know, they were all about pushing French cuisine in Chicago and elevating the cuisine. So I believe that I succeeded so well because I really put everything I had into it. But more importantly, I had people who believed in me, and that's what's important right now. You always have to have people who recognize you, but I never put my sex before who I was. It was all about, it didn't, you know, I worked with all men and you just got used to it. But I would say it was those formidable years at the Ritz. I wish that everybody could start their career with something like that, because it really, I look back at them and say to myself, I was very, very fortunate.
Well, you know, hotel training is really significant. We recently had a chef from Hawaii, Chan Savelle, on, who worked around the Four Seasons quite a bit. He said it was just very formative to learn all the different positions and everything. And, you know, even though you didn't let your sex get in the way, I do want to point out that Jean Bonchet ended up hiring you to work at Le Francais, right? And you were the first woman chef there. So you were a first in that arena. And I will say opened the door for many others as well. Even though we don't say of who are women, but it was a long road for many to get to that point. And you just showed how much hard work and dedication. I mean, you had to really toe the line and work the hours and do the work. And you illustrate it's hard.
It's very, very hard. And I, you know, a lot of times my father would question me when you come home and your fingers are stained from, you know, torneying 100 pounds of potatoes, or you have a bruise, or you have cut and burns and things like that. And I'd say, oh my God, I just love it. Every day I'm creating. And I have to say that when I was put in the Garmager with another woman chef who was the chef of Garmager, I said, this isn't for me. After the first day, you know, I was just brazen enough. I'm really, you know, people find it hard to believe, but I really am shy. They find it hard to believe, but certain instances I am shy. And I went to the chef and I said, you know what, this isn't for me. I can't put 500 Ritz crackers down and put a dab of mayonnaise and a cornet of salami and a slice of cornichon and all that, and I relish how beautiful it looks, but it's just not for me. And he just looked at me and went, what did you just say? I go, it's not for me. I gotta cook. I can't do this. You know, I'll work here, but you need to understand that my goal, and I would point right to the line where the French, the dining room, and I'd say, that's where I want to go. And then they put me, you know, they put me over in banquets, and they realized right out of the gate, okay, if this girl's going to work here, we're never going to get a banquet out, because my detail and how I, you know, looked at every single thing, it was like, okay, well, we need to do 50 of these platters, and, you know, this isn't the way we do it. And I finally fought my way and got right into the line, and I was as happy as I could possibly be. But it was at this time that I met the men that would later lead the Four Seasons. So when I joined Four Seasons, so I started at the Ritz and I ended before I opened our restaurant, I was with Four Seasons. So the men that I met when I was 17, when I was, you know, 28 or 30 and joined them as a chef, I knew them already. So they knew me. So it was like a very welcoming homecoming, in the sense that we all knew what to expect of each other. But the men that I met who were just like assistant managers and food and beverage directors, when I became chef, they were, you know, they were number two and threes to like Isidore Sharp, the founder of Four Seasons. So it was, I always say that the Ritz and Chicago, everybody in Four Seasons who made it always came through Chicago, because of the power of the business. But it was a great time. I remember a couple times where the chefs would look at me, and, you know, they were all French, very intimidating, and they'd say, are you sure that this is what you want to do? Are you sure? And they'd look at me because, you know, here you are, you know, a girl from the suburbs, and you're cooking in a kitchen, and you're so out of place, and they're looking at you like, are you sure you don't want to like do something else? Like, what else do you like to do? And I look at them and I go, you think I'm not going to make it, right? I'm going to make it, and I'm going to make it happen. And, years later, when I was an executive chef of Four Seasons, some of these guys were executive chefs, and we would laugh about it. But, you know, I think it's very important at this point in everyone's life that you always have to maintain these friendships, and you have to mentor to keep moving forward. You know, so I find that I do mentor a lot of people.
Mentoring is so important in this business because it is tough and it can be cruel. It is, you know, the kitchen is not the most, you know, some are, but a lot of people have said it's a tough, you know, tough love place. And particularly we've all read about some of the famous French restaurants where, you know, you've been screamed at and you had to do a lot of things. And how do you keep, tell us about your kitchen. It's not a big kitchen. We saw it. I mean, you know, Brandy is not a massive restaurant. It's a, you said, I think 50 seats, right?
50 seats? A jewel box. We call it a jewel box of a restaurant. And it would have been a lot smaller if Tom had not realized that there was a larger footprint that we could grow on. So we actually added, where the kitchen is, we added two stories there. So the right beneath us is, like, you know, the laundry, because we do all of our beautiful linens in-house. And not to make the day even harder, we do our own linens in-house too, right? And then, you know, the dressing area for the staff and the coolers and things like that. But I mean, Tom had the vision. We designed the kitchen. I had designed a few kitchens for Four Seasons. Being executive chef, you always were doing that. So I had just come off of designing two new kitchens at the Four Seasons Los Angeles. And when we did Naha, Naha is an imposing line. It was a very large kitchen. It was right. It was great. And Brandy is a smaller version of it. And Brandy is I cook every single night. You have to understand, I work a station every single night. The cooks that work by me, they work next to the chef and owner every single night. So that in itself, you have to be a strong cook to work next to the chef, because there's days that I'm buried and they help me, and there's days they're buried and I help them. But it's a pleasure to cook at Brandy, even as tight as it is, because everything you have is on your station. And it's designed in such a manner that you really never have to walk more than a foot to get what you need. You have your sinks, you have all your refrigeration, your drawer, all your cooking. Everything is right there. Unless you didn't bring it up from the cooler, everything is right there. And it is small, but it keeps you tight. It keeps everyone organized. And you also get to see every single dish. And that was the same thing at Brandy, how Tom designed the flow of the kitchen was so that if I was working the pass, if I was expediting, I could see every single dish going out from, like, pastry and garmage, but I could also watch the baristas make the espressos and cappuccinos and that sort of thing. And I could also see all the plates coming back to see who was eating, who wasn't eating, what was going on in the dining room. So it's easy to work in a, you know, the more space you have, the more you spread out. It's like having a big house, you know, and then all of a sudden you move to an apartment.
We know all about that.
or in our case, an SUV. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I know. But how much fun is that? You're like the second person I know that did that.
We're living the dream. It's been really good. Let's talk about the menu, because it's a beautiful menu. It is seasonal. So what we had may not be there, but you have some perennial favorites. So talk to us about that.
Well, we recently just brought, I don't know if we did it in September, but we recently brought back Dover sole, which certainly everyone loved pre-pandemic, but then we had to wait until we could, you know, till things came, could be brought in again from Europe and the freight and everything. And then teaching new cooks how to, you know, when you have a whole fish coming in and you're cooking it to order and then deboning it and making the dish and you're doing that 18 times a night, just think about it, along with seven other things you have on your station. And So, obviously, we have great steaks. Our lacquered aged Moulard duck breast from Hudson Valley, you know, from the, your neck of the woods. Really tremendous foie gras.
Where in the Hudson Valley, Carrie, do you get your duck breast?
From Michael Gennore at Hudson
Valley. Michael Gennore.
Yeah,
so awesome.
He does our foie and he does our duck breast.
The best.
And, you know, he's been a constant for everyone in the industry during this whole crisis. I mean, his leadership and his ability to keep us all in the food that we need is great. So I think I never like to say, oh, we have, you know, this is a regular on the menu. But like right now we have, you know, wild shot wood pigeon from Scotland with flavors of winter. And everyone goes crazy for that because it's like a grand mare with, you know, the pearl onions and bacon and chestnuts and
everything. Truffle.
For fall, winter. Venison. I have a thing that I never do venison until the first snow. And then I got so tired of waiting for the first snow, which just, by the way, happened yesterday, that I put venison on early, change of pace, and grand veneur with huckleberries and luxury pumpkin. And we do incredible fish, salmon, Pine Island prawns from Florida that I met. I was introduced to them during the shutdown. I happened to get a phone call and said, hey, I see on social media you're in Naples in Marco Island and we're in Pine Island and give me your address and I'm going to send you something. And that's how it all started. You know,
sometimes you served us the prawns.
We actually had those prawns while we were there. They're fabulous. Just
the
delicious.
Prawns, the tart tatins. You know, yep. I think the greatest compliment a chef, not just myself, but any chef can get is when a person says, I don't know what to order because everything looks so good. And there's only a handful of restaurants that you really always say that to. Some people come in and they know immediately, I'm going to have the steak tartare, the Dover sole, and the clafoutis. You know, it's a done deal. I'm having the ribeye. You know, the beautiful greens with Roquefort and roasted pears and, you know, white truffle honey and things like that. And they know immediately, oh, I'm going to have the pavé for dessert. I like when a person comes in and they're like, I don't know what to order because I like how everything sounds. So it's always key to deliver on. It can look great on paper, but then you have to deliver on it. So we always have great soups and different types of, you know, coddled eggs. And right now we have a warm egg salad. So I think, I just feel inspiration anywhere I go. And right now it's winter. So you're just trying to make people feel the season. You know, yes, you can get asparagus. And we cook for a guest every Sunday. We deliver to her. And she loves corn. And I've stopped trying to tell her that corn's out of season. And she'll say to me, but isn't it in season somewhere? And you're like, yeah. So I just get her the corn. I quit trying to tell her. Corn isn't on my menu, but for her, I'll make her. It is for her. So some people can eat asparagus year-round, and some people can't.
Well, you know, I have a question about that. But first, just for our listeners, I have the menu up. Okay. So the Dover sole. I love Dover sole. It is so special. Serve with pomme puree Joël Robuchon. Okay. You had me at Joël Robuchon. Buttered leeks, beurre noisette, brioche crouton, capers, toasted hazelnuts, lemon slices, and candied lemon butter. That just is like, I want that for my birthday. Oh, I'm not going to Chicago for my birthday. Oh, God, that looks fabulous.
It'll be here in some rendition the next time you come.
And, you know, the squash that you have on right now, I think it's important because it is a spaghetti squash, which I happen to love, sweet potato crisp, mutsu, apples, and blossom honey. Is that cream-based or broth-based?
Well, we have two. So we don't cream it until service. So we make it with a squash stock, and it keeps it vegetarian. But once we somewhat review who's coming in, and unless someone tells us, you know, like that they're vegan or they want the dairy intolerant or something, then at the start of service, the cream goes into the soup. The cream and the butter.
Are you seeing a lot more of that? Are you seeing a lot more of customers coming in with their list? Because, I mean, I think it would be frustrating, but I've done it myself. Tell me.
You know, the one thing that teaches you to accept what others are struggle through, you know, some people it's an intolerance and some people it's a preference, and it's not up to me to judge that person. If I could do it, I'll do it. If I can't, then I'll say, you know, it's not possible. But certainly if you, I've seen people, the servers come in with a card and they just hand it to you. And I love when they have that. When a person has so many allergies or, you know, unfortunate in their life that they have so many things to overcome every time they go out, and you look at it and then you realize 90% of these things we don't use, you know, like kiwi and soy sauce and, you know, MSG and things like that. But we try to accommodate as best as we can, and sometimes we can't. You know, some people are like, I want to have the Dover sole, but I can't have butter. So you just look at the server and go, they realize it's going to be an entirely different dish. Cooking Dover sole in olive oil, there's nothing wrong with it, but there's nothing, you're not going to get that full experience of having the French quince vinegar butter sauce with the candied lemon and the plum puree. And let's go to the plum puree, because I can't tell you how many people have come in with their little kids, because a lot of people bring their children to Brundy, and the little kids will say to me, we ate potatoes Joe Robuchon when we were in Paris at his restaurant. And you look at them and you're like, and how was it? Well, these are really, really, it's just like when we were in Paris. And they're so excited because here's a 7-year-old and they know who Joe Robuchon is. And there's 25-year-old chefs that don't know who Joe Robuchon are right now.
So, that's so funny.
I think it's important that you always attach someone's name. We did last year, 2020 and 2021, we did Thanksgiving to go at Brundy because we were in shutdown in 2020. So we just decided, you know, I always did Thanksgiving when I was a chef of Four Seasons. How hard can it be? Well, it's really hard when there's like you and, you know, two cooks, right? To do Thanksgiving for 1,000 people. But we did potatoes Joe Robuchon for Thanksgiving. And people go insane for it because it's just like, it's like a potato milkshake. It's just,
it's
so,
because it's so,
because it's half butter.
Yeah, and you know, you can't go, I don't do dairy. If you're gonna go that way, you go all the way with those potatoes because they really are amazing.
Yeah, I feel bad for the people that have these intolerances or preferences or whatever. But sometimes when it's so big, I'll go to the table and I'll look right at them and say, I want to make you the meal that you want. So just tell me, you know, what's going to happen if, you know, like, I don't know if every element didn't have butter attached to it. Like, I don't know if that pumpkin seed had olive oil or did it maybe get a touch of butter. And they'll go, well, you know, I'm just trying to watch my weight. And then you're like, okay, you... And then you look at it, but you can't judge them. So you just say to yourself, okay, as long as I know, or some people say, don't worry, I have an EpiPen if something happens. Then you know the seriousness. So you have a scale of 0 to 100, and you just work. You just work in it. I'm just there to make your memory, to have a great experience, to have a great meal. And I love that people who have severe allergies, that they do leave their house and they go out and they find a way to. We have people who come to French afternoon tea and they can't have gluten. And you're just like, okay, so I'll go to them and say, let's just forget all of this. And I'm just going to cook you a great lunch. And they love that. You know, like I cook them a great fish, you know, a starter, whatever. And their friends are having tea and they're having lunch. So sometimes you just have to. You have to put yourself in their shoes.
So, and they have to put their trust in you too.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So you're open for Tuesdays through Thursdays 5 to 10. So when do you do afternoon tea?
We do afternoon tea on Fridays and Saturdays. We just finished our last ones. We do them Fridays and Saturdays because we're just, you know, we just love afternoon tea. You know, I saw it in Paris one time. you know, my last time I was in Paris, I sat at La Durée with some friends. Mm. I'm looking around going, I don't know why I didn't think of this sooner. I could do tea. And when I get back to Chicago, I'm going to tell Michael we're going to do French afternoon tea. And it'll be so amazing. And we'll do it, you know, certain times of the year. So we do it on Fridays and Saturdays for the holiday season in December. And then our next one is Valentine's Day. And then we might do a spring or a Mother's Day, but then we take the whole summer off. And then, you know, because on Saturdays, select Saturdays, hopefully going into the new year, we'll be able to start it up again. We do cooking classes and wine lunches on Saturdays. So we do private. It could be one-on-one or it could be up to 8 people. And I teach everyone I teach them a dinner party with our pastry chef, Craig Harzewski. We teach a dinner party, and then we teach you everything. You're right in the kitchen. You have all the recipes, and I do all the cooking, and they all watch. And or if they want to be involved, they can. And then afterwards, they go in the dining room, and Michael, you know, serves them what I taught them, we now serve them and we ramp it up and say, okay, so this is how you make it like we do in the restaurant. And then Michael pairs it with wine and he answers any questions they have about wine and cocktails and service and just in general, how to do a great dinner party from the music to the ambiance. And so we do those on select Saturdays.
That's fun. That's a great way to engage with your customers as well. I could see you doing a tea for kids, those Joel Robichon eating mashed potato eating kids. You should do a tea party for those same kids.
Yeah, it's it fun. Really it's cute. Really you'll have to, you know, I could at some point you'll see it maybe on the website or something. But the entire bar is covered in pastries, desserts.
Well, actually.
Ooh, I can see it on the website.
I'm on the website now, and if you go to the events tab, it's right there, and it's just a gorgeous setup.
And this is a good time to say Brandi's website is www.brindille-chicago.com. It's a beautiful site. I have to do give a shout out to your photographer, Paul Straubing, who's one of the most talented photographers, period, in the United States, because the photography is great. And I have to say grateful also because when – I don't know about you, David, when I'm writing and doing a lot of research for different outlets or for this show for food photos, it's really hard to get good photography. Everyone needs to have a gallery on their website tip with photos that we can download with credit. It would save the journalists so much time. You have no idea. These are beautiful photos.
Well, you know, they capture – you know, you create it, you tell them, you know, Paul is exceptional because he's worked with, you know, so many great chefs and he's photographed, Sebastian and Jackie's books from the French pastry school. And he's just so easygoing and, you know, it's stress-free. You know, when you tell a chef you're doing a photo shoot, it either brings you sheer terror or it's like, oh, quiet. It's great because you're just cooking. You know, some photographers you work with, they're like, I'll say, well, you can eat this. Oh, it's edible? It's like, well, what do you think? Yeah, of course it's edible. You know, it's not fake food. We make it. And you have to remember that photographers are so used to every different, it's like cooking. Every different, there's a facet for every purpose. And Paul makes you feel so at home. When I came up with this, you know, we have to do something at the holidays last year. And Michael's like, let's do those Epicurean baskets like they have at Harrods and Fortnum and Mason. Let's do that. And then we expanded to cookie tins and chocolate boxes and design your own ice cream. I picked up the phone and called Paul and I said, hey, would you photograph for this for me? And he came right over. He was just like, no problem. You know, he wasn't afraid during the whole shutdown. And he just makes you feel so relaxed. So I'm glad you enjoy all his
photos.
Well,
the photos are beautiful. You do have a very attractive gift guide with those baskets, aforementioned baskets. And you also have customized ice cream from your pastry chef.
Crazy. Crazy how unbelievable. Yeah, sometimes you know, like we just got an order for it last night for a man whose wife gave it to him for Christmas, and we just love, because you know, they interact with Craig. I don't really get involved. I'll say thank you for your order, and then your contact is Craig, and then they talk amongst themselves, and sometimes it's completely stoner, like, you know, chocolate covered macadamia nuts with double chunk, rocky road, cherry, and you just like everything but the kitchen sink. And then other times it's like, I just want a really good, you know, chocolate ice cream with, you know, peanut butter with big chunks of chocolate in it. And you're like, okay, well, we can do that.
It is a great gift idea. The Craig we're talking about is it Craig Harzewski?
Harzewski. I think he's one of the best pastry chefs in the country. Yeah. And he's very humble. And, you know, everything he, you know, I've now taught him in, you know, every pastry chef has this hidden desire to be a savory chef. So Craig, you know, during everything, you know, we've taught him so much that he, you know, he'll come to me and go, all right, so show me how you're making that venison sauce, you know, and he wants to be more than just be known as a pastry chef. But I can only do what I do because he has that.
Yeah. Well, first of all,
and he's got
a great
pedigree in his own right, too.
Yeah. I mean, really, what a great gift idea, the customized ice cream. Carrie, we've come to the – it's so fast. First of all, I want to point out, you have acknowledged almost everyone who works with you, which is, I think, an incredible representation of your generous heart. You have shouted out everyone who's part of your team. You've shown that you are with them all the way in the kitchen. And you get that feeling when you walk into Bundy. The food is fantastic. I can't wait to go back and eat at a table, not just the bar. I loved eating the bar, by the way. I really love eating at the bar, but
Thank you. It was great.
And we can't wait to come back. We are so grateful that you shared your time on our table today on the Connected Table.
Thank you so much for having me. And I wish you a great new year, and I'm sure we'll see each other at some point, somewhere we can connect over a table having great food.
Well,
I hope to
do that sooner rather than later.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So this is the last show of 2021. Oh, let's celebrate and wrap it up with some really great champagne on New Year's Eve, David, when I see you again. Mm-hmm. Until then, to all our listeners, we hope you have a healthy, happy 2022. Stay positive, test negative, and always stay insatiably curious.